Eldridge Street. I discovered, however, that I was the original house we lived in was 19 Allen Street, which was I discovered later was a pretty slum, quite a slum tenement. It was the first house my father lived in with my mother, and that's when I was born in 1913. And of course, right along
what date exactly?
May 17, 1913, the elevated structure, which no longer exists in New York City, the elevated just ran right alongside the apartment. We were just on the level with the elevated train, so people could look in and we could look out and see each other on trains.
This was on the Lower East Side?
Lower East Side.
Now, do you know how old you were when you have your first memories?
About 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. And then we moved because my parents didn't like the idea of living right next to the elevator. First, it ran all night, so it always woke you, apparently. But so they moved to a street just a block away called Eldridge Street. Mm-hmm. Eldridge, Eldridge Street. I discovered later it was named after some minor naval hero in the War of 1812. And there we lived on the 5th floor, a walk-up. To walk up 5 flights up and 5 flights down, and there was no toilets either in the house or in the hall, so the toilets were downstairs in the backyard. Mm-hmm. So if you want to go to the toilet to defecate, you know, as far as urination was concerned, you just peed in the sink. But you had to go downstairs 5 flights to use the toilet, winter, summer, spring. And when I was little, of course, my mother or father would go with me, and you'd go into a toilet downstairs in the backyard. This was quite a slum.
Are these buildings still, do they still exist?
I think so. But, of course, they've been completely changed. They've been gutted and probably fixed up. I didn't have a bathtub in my house until I was 17 years old and a freshman at Columbia College. There was no bathtub. Mm-hmm. When you were young, you were washed, as a child, you were washed in the wash tub. Mm-hmm. And if you needed a big bath, I went with my father Thursday nights to a Turkish bath, where we would scrub, you know, and wash up and so on.
Now, tell me about your father. When did he come to the United States?
He came to the United States.
And where from?
From the Ukraine, part of Tsarist Russia at the time. And a part of Tsarist Russia, which after World War I became part of Poland and then went back again to now Soviet Russia. He had been in the Tsarist army and had some service in the Russo-Japanese War. He told me some interesting things, one of them which is quite impressive, and I think it's worth mentioning. While the Tsar and the court and the leadership, the Tsarist leadership, were anti-Semitic and no great purveyors of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, which had its origins in Tsarist Russia, a very peculiar thing was that there was still a great respect for religion by the Tsarist government, so that on the Sabbath there was printed within the prayer book, the Hebrew prayer book in the synagogue, a prayer for the Tsar, the Tsarina, Tsarevich, and the whole Tsarist family, and you had, this was in Hebrew, and you had to make this prayer, you had to utter this prayer, on pain if you didn't, somebody would reveal it to the local police chief, and then the synagogue would be punished, or the parishioners, the congregation would be punished. And another example he told me, when he served in the army, the Tsarist government willingly helped them observe their religion. For example, Jews did not have to eat unkosher food. Either they were quartered with Jewish families in whatever district, military district they were serving in, or else if they weren't, there was nobody to quarter them with, somehow they got food which could be kosher. In other words, it wouldn't be meat, it might be vegetables, bread. And my father told me this amazing story. There was a rule in the army that if you were going on overnight maneuvers, the Jewish soldiers had to be told that they were going on overnight so they could take with them their prayer shawl and their phylacteries so they could say morning prayers. Well, the sergeant he had was an anti-Semite and deliberately didn't tell him that they were going on overnight maneuvers. And when morning came, of course, no Jew could eat because you may not eat unless you've said your morning prayers. And they could not eat because you're unclean and whatever the reason is. So word got around all over the encampment, the Jews are not eating, the Jews are not eating. Well, the word got to what is called the Rotterkommandier, the colonel. And the colonel heard about this, so he immediately called all his battalion or whatever it was, brigade, on parade, stood him and brought the sergeant before him. He then berated the sergeant for what he had done, ripped off his stripes and shoulder pads, and immediately ordered all the Jews to be put in wagons. There were no automobiles at that time, be put into wagons and rushed back to the encampment where the Jews had their prayer shawls and phylacteries, and to get there before noon, because after noon you've lost a day. And they got there in time to be able to say their prayers. And as my father said, you can be sure with Stalin this wouldn't have happened. So he had a sort of a grudging affection or of admiration or tolerance for the Tsarist regime because they respected religion, even though they were anti-Semitic.
Right. So now, do you know when he came to the United States?
Since he was in the Russo-Japanese War, there have been 1905. He came after the Japanese, let's say 1906 or 7. You see, the reason... For example, I'm not even sure I know when my father was born, or we know when he died, of course, but when he was born, because they all went by the Hebrew calendar, which is, of course, entirely different and keeps changing because the Hebrew calendar is a lunar calendar and the Gregorian calendar, or Julian, not lunar, so the dates never coincide. My birthday, May 17th, has no meaning in terms of the Hebrew calendar because it's an entirely different system. So that's why I'm unsure about dates. So whatever dates he had, for example, for an insurance policy, he'd make it up, mm-hmm. Roughly, because there was no way that you could determine what was what. So I would say he came to this country probably because he lost the sight of an eye in the war, and he figured he'd better get out before he lost the other one. Mm-hmm. Out of the army, yeah. And get out of the country, actually, because he served his time, but he had enough, so he decided to come to America. He had a nephew living here. So he arrived, I would say, about 1906. In New York, Ellis Island, with a dollar in his pocket. And he was very proud of what happened. When he arrived in Ellis Island, he had a single dollar, which his nephew had sent him, and a ticket to go to where the nephew lived in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Well, his pocket was picked on Ellis Island, so no ticket and no dollar. And there he is at the Battery, having come in Ellis Island, admitted, and there he is at the Battery. Where do you go? He's never been in the country or New York City. So he started walking and sort of muttering, finding somebody to ask in Yiddish, and discovered where the synagogue of his Landesleiter, there was a habit among the Jews when they left Russia or Poland, when they came to New York, to form synagogues based around the town they came from. So if you came from Kiev, there was a Kiev synagogue, and which people you knew or relatives you knew and so on. And he went looking for the synagogue of the Kolk, K-O-L-K. That was the village he came from, which he described as a village. If you went into this village with a horse and wagon, the horse would be at one end of the village and the wagon would be at the other end. No sidewalks, just board and so on. And he finally, by a miracle, managed to find the synagogue of the Kolk, the Jews from Kolk. And he went up there. It was on Broome Street on the east side, I believe. And he went up and introduced himself. and he was immediately given a job. I mean, somebody found it to deliver ice on to go up five flights of stairs, four flights. Those days there were no refrigerators, you had ice. And he delivered ice all day, and he made his first dollar on the Friday. Then somebody found a place for him to board and to sleep, and he went to synagogue on that first Friday. And within a couple of weeks, he was, you know, delivering ice, and then that became a little onerous. And somebody got him into the business of selling dry goods, and he started selling as a peddler. Then he finally got a store and so on.
And he didn't go to Baltimore?
I never went to Baltimore.
Now, was he, I mean, approximately, would he have been, say, in his 20s then, or you think, or
no, I would
late
think
teens? Or
I would think probably 30. Cause
oh,
he'd
it could
been
be 30.
Yeah, because he'd been in the Army for 4 years, whatever that term of service was. So he was not in his early 20s by any means. But he was an orphan child. He had no father, no mother. He was raised by an older brother. His mother died in childbirth, and his father died in bed with him one night. You know, woke up and there was his father dead. So he was raised by an older brother, and since he had no parents, he had no money. And since he had no money, he couldn't go to Hebrew school. Of course, he had to pay the teacher something, and there was nobody to pay him. So what he did is he listened to the rabbi teaching the children outside of a window. He'd listen to an open window and thereby learned prayers and became quite learned afterwards.
So did he get married shortly after he came to America?
He was married before he came to America. He married my mother, then left her to sort of get settled. Then he brought her over.
Oh, I see. So she came out.
She came a couple of years later.
Now, were you? do you have any brothers and sisters?
Two sisters, older.
Oh, they.
I'm sorry, younger.
Younger. So you were the first child.
I was the first. Well, I was the first that lived. She apparently had a couple of miscarriages before me, which would account, I think, for the lateness. They both lived to very ripe old age. My father, I suspect, must have been about 94 when he died, and my mother was 88. And my father, I must say, the doctors said that there was really nothing wrong. He just died of boredom. Because when you live to that ripe old age, everybody you know is gone, your wife is gone, your children live far away. All you do is living in a home. And
what year did he die?
I think it was 1969.
Mm-hmm. I see. Really? Are your sisters still alive?
Yeah. Quite long life, too.
What are their names?
One is Minna, and the other is Lillian. Mm-hmm. And Lillian lives in Florida, and Minna lives in Riverdale in New York, because she has a son and grandchildren. Mm-hmm. So she's pretty well tied in New York very happily.
So anyway, now after you, what was the name of this place where you were living again when you were young?
Allen Street.
Allen Street, and then you moved to
Eldridge Street.
Yeah. And what was your father doing then? What was he?
Peddling cotton goods, and then opening up a store. And the store is ridiculous. It was a cellar thing. It went way down, fantastic. It was like going down, you know, the subway escalator in Knightsbridge in London, just deep down. God, and having to walk up and down those things. It was quite a place. And finally, after years and years of finally managing it, he moved to a store which only had 4 steps down. But one interesting thing about my father, which just amazed me, he was, as I said, very religious and very observant. And one Friday night, it was in the winter when it gets dark pretty early, as he was closing up to go home, wash, and then go to the synagogue with me, I'd be young, a man suddenly appeared out of nowhere and said he wants to make a big order. And my father said, you'll have to come back on Sunday. Because Saturday, of course, they were closed. You'll have to come back on Sunday. I said, but I need it now. I can't wait. He said, my father said, closing. He said, I'm sorry, I have to go to synagogue. And I remonstrated my father. I must have been about 10 or 11. I said, but Papa, we haven't had a sale all day. We don't need a depression. We need money. I mean, this, I said, "What? You could have done this whole thing?" He said, "Oh, no. That was probably somebody sent by the devil to come here at this moment. Hmm. Once I'd open up, they'll let them go in there. We'd start haggling over something. And then, and pretty soon it'll be an hour, and it'll be dark, and I would have violated the Sabbath. If he wants to, he'll be back on Sunday. If he's not back on Sunday, then I know for sure the devil sent him." But, you know, it's really quite, quite living by principle.
Right.
So, I mean, it might have been on the level. Might have been, you know, $20 order would have been, you know, just astounding. Didn't bother him one bit. Nor did it my mother. Now, yeah, probably it was the devil testing you out. There's full this kind of, among Orthodox Jews, there is this kind of belief that you're always being tested. And the Talmud is full of stories like that.
I see, yes. Now, when you were young, were you helping him out in various ways?
To some extent, I had no interest in going into the business. It's quite obvious. And neither did my father particularly. He wanted me to become a learned man. His hope, as most Orthodox Jews, is that their sons would become rabbis or preachers or something. And so he was sending me to Hebrew school, even though he could have used me, you know, to deliver packages and do the sums and whatever. But on the contrary, he sent me to Hebrew school. So I'd go to school, and he wanted me to go to a parochial school, and I...
Meaning what?
Which would have been an all-day school, where you would also learn, you know, secular, mm-hmm. Secular subjects, mathematics and so on, but most of the day you'd be devoted to studying Talmud and Mishnah, the Bible, and so on. But I rebelled against that, because we had a school right next door to me on Eldridge Street, PS 65, Public School 65. So I went to Hebrew school afterwards. So my day would begin, you know, 7 o'clock, you know, wake up, go to school by 8:30, get home at 3, grab a sandwich and a glass of milk, and then go to Hebrew school for 3 hours from 4 to 7. So it became quite...
How long did you do that for?
Oh, till I was about... 16, I guess. Mm-hmm. 15.
What are your... Describe this PS...
65?
65.
PS 65 is a public school on Eldridge Street between Hester and Canal Street. It still stands. And it's where we had good teachers and awful teachers. People, you know, we had certain teachers were called moiters, or the East Side way of saying murderers. They beat you. Either with a ruler or, you know, crush your buttocks or slap you or throw you to the ground. It was quite a place. And then some others who were very wonderful, to whom I'm very grateful, especially in my high school days, who encouraged my writing. And one of them turned out to be the father of David Horowitz, you know, Peter Collier's partner, who in his book Destructive Generations describes a man named Philip Horowitz, who was an English teacher. And I called David and said, "Was this your father?" He says, "Yes." His father was a party member at the time. And yet to this Philip Horowitz I owe everything, because he encouraged me to write. I liked writing because I could read my essays aloud in class. I was always called upon. I was held up as a sort of a model writer. I remember writing an essay on Silas Marner, mm-hmm. the Eliot novel, and my teacher called on me to read it aloud. I don't remember what it was like.
What age are we talking about now when Philip Horowitz?
Oh, 13, 14, 15. No, I would say probably 15, because he encouraged me to go out to compete on the newspaper. They had a bi-weekly newspaper, mm-hmm. the Seward Fortnightly. And I became the editor finally. In my senior high school year, I became the editor.
This is all still at the same school on the
same
east side?
Same school, yeah.
Because I know Horowitz describes his father as living in, I think it's Sunnyside.
That's right.
But that would have been later, I guess.
I wasn't. The teachers didn't live near where
lived.
He just lived there. Sunnyside happened to be a place where there were a lot of communists. It had become a sort of a settlement for communists. But Philip Horowitz used to stay after school. And there were two others, I think, with me. We formed a club called the 2R Club. Now, you know what the 3 R's are, reading, writing, arithmetic. Well, we dropped arithmetic and became the 2R Club. And he would encourage us. We'd read things to him. He would edit them, correct them, advise us. And he was a, I don't know if, I don't think he was married at the time, but it was so wonderful to have a man who was warm and concerned and never raised any question of politics whatsoever. So I owe him a great deal. Then there was a woman named Nolan, Margaret Nolan, an Irish woman who's also very encouraging about literature and poetry. I wrote poetry, which got published in the magazine The Seward Folio. And then there was Eunice Elkind, who was an English teacher, too. Somehow the English teachers were the ones that I gravitated to. And Latin. I liked Latin a great deal, and I can still recite Quovisquem tandem abitere Catalina nostra patientia. Quem ad finem sese effrenate iactabit.
What does that mean?
No. That's Catiline. That's the first oration by Cicero against Catiline.
I see.
How much longer, O Catiline, will you abuse our patience? To what ends will your mad frenzy take us? And then there was Arma Verumque Cano Caeap Troia Boris. Virgil. I loved Latin because it has a sort of, as you can see, a declamatory power.
Right.
Which is very exciting.
Right. Now tell me, what about the student body? Was it mostly Jewish or was it the various...
Jewish and Italian. Uh-huh. A lot of Jewish and Italian. No blacks at that time, practically none. But I would say Jewish, Italian, that's all I remember. And the reason I went out for, I think in part, the reason I went out for the paper is because I discovered that if you're a reporter, even though you're tiny and smaller than everybody else, and I was shorter than everybody else, you became very important, especially if you were a sports, you wanted to be the sports reporter. So I would travel with the basketball team to play somebody in Brooklyn, some team in Brooklyn, and then they'd say, hey, you going to mention my name? You going to put my name in? I made all those goals. And suddenly you discover that even though you're barely 5 feet, mm-hmm. you're getting lots and lots of attention from guys who are much bigger than you are. And I discovered that's a good way to go. Mm-hmm. So that's how I became a journalist.
Do you have any friends or anyone particularly among the students that you remember or still remember or remained in contact with?
None. Because I quickly decided that if I wanted to go anywhere, I had to really break out from what was the City College syndrome. I determined I would not go to City College. And I wanted to go to a place... See, I was influenced very much by a series of books. You know the name Frank Merriwell?
Mm-hmm.
Frank Merriwell, those paperbacks, you could get them, you know, for a nickel, and you could...
You better tell me about them.
Merriwell was an honorable young man who went to Yale. Mm-hmm. And they had a wonderful time at Yale. And they were full of very honorable principles. And there was Bartley Hodge, the hot-tempered Bart Hodge. And then there was Frank Merriwell's girlfriend, Inez, and so on. The whole thing was so absolutely different from anything I knew on the East Side. Yale, girls, you know, a whole other world full of green. And the only green we had was in Central Park. And I lived in the tenement, which was full of mostly Italians, and my friends were Italian. One of them, I had... This, if you put it in a novel, nobody believes it, but it literally happened. One of my friends was a guy named Joe Ganji. We used to steal together, you know, bananas off push carts, and he became, you know, we used to sneak into movie theaters. You know, he was quite a guy, and I followed him. My father was horrified about him, and he remonstrated with Joe Ganji's parents that he shouldn't lead me astray, and they said, what can we do? We're, you know, totally helpless. Years and years later, in 1936 or 7, I'll get to where, how I got there. I was sitting in the lineup room of police headquarters in the days when having a lineup was not considered a violation of civil rights, where they bring in the night's catch and parade them before all the detectives. And I was not a detective, but I was an investigator. And there, the what they called the lineup man called out a name. And then the guy who undressed would be brought up to stand on the slider platform with spotlights and markings for his height. And he calls out, Joe Ganji. And then he would describe why he was arrested. And Joe Ganshi was arrested for having shot and killed a jeweler named Lukowitz on Grand and Allen Street, which was a felony murder. And now look, there's my boyhood friend with whom I used to go stealing bananas. And, the sort of thing which happens, in real life is improbable in fiction.
So what happened to him?
He went to electric chair.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my boyhood friend. And I just, you think of it, when you tell the story, you can tell it, but you can't put it in a book because nobody would believe it. And I've got all names, but...
Was he guilty, do you think?
Oh, yes. Oh, there's no question about that. He was caught, he shot the jeweler and they got the jewelry on him. There's no question about it. I was particularly interested to find out. But there I am sitting in the dark and he's up, in the spotlight. It's quite an experience.
Well, you were lucky he didn't lead you astray, I guess you could say.
I don't think I could have been led astray because I'd been raised, I think, by my parents with a great regard for honesty. Mm-hmm. That's why, see, the Frank Merriwell thing was very important to me. There's one episode where Frank Merriwell is running for office at one of the Yale classes, and there's a close race with a man who's his opponent, somebody like Dick Whittington or some kind of name like that. And Bartley Hodge is so determined that Frank Merriwell should not lose the election that surreptitiously he moved some votes, some ballots, out of the hat for the opponent into Frank Merriwell. And Frank Merriwell is the only man who sees him do it. And he goes up to Hodge and says, Bart, I've seen what you've done. Put those ballots back, And Bart says, I can't. We're not going to let him win. If you don't, you're my friend, but I will expose you right here in this room. I was just absolutely overwhelmed. Because this is not the way I had heard it done. If you could steal a vote, you stole a vote. That's what they did. And it was such a shocking thing to read. And I, as you can see, I remember it. Whether or not it had some final influence, who knows? My parents had some influence, I suppose. Or maybe fear. I was scared of cops. Mm-hmm.
And but you don't have any particular friendships that you remember from the school, at any rate?
At that time?
Yeah.
None, because they haven't lasted. See, I was determined to break away for all these various reasons, and I was not going to go to City College. That I was just absolutely not going to go.
Now, wait a minute. Jumping ahead here, why would you even be expected to go to City College?
Because everybody went to City College. This was a free college.
Uh-huh.
It was free. And nobody had ever gone to Columbia for my high school. Uh-huh. And everybody regarded it as kind of ha, ha, ha. In the yearbooks, you'd put down, your name, when the senior yearbook, name, ambition, so on. And I put down Columbia as the college that I wanted to go to. And people laughed because if you went through Page, it'd be CCNY, at best NYU, or maybe Wisconsin or something.
Yes.
But nobody ever went there. People would put down University of Mississippi. That's a big joke. But I put down Columbia. And I didn't have good enough grades to get in. I got some decent grades, but nothing that great. So I wanted to break away from this pattern.
Columbia presumably was fee-paying, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so
$300 a year.
So this would have been an expense.
That's right.
For
and
you
for my father, and as well as myself. But when I did get to Columbia, I worked my way through. As a waiter. And
well, now, first, tell me a bit about this Hebrew school.
That was where you, it was not a full day, it was part-time, from 3 to 7. See, a lot of the kids rebelled against going all day to a rabbinical school.
Mm-hmm.
We were probably, refusing to go along with a lot. Because, the United States and New York City, with the temptations, it's very difficult to be religious, at least for me it was. I was, because that was my father did, but eventually I broke away, very much so. But I was raised so that I, learned the Bible for the Old Testament, and, various parts of the other parts of the Old Testament pretty well. But the first five books, you study them year after year, the same, you repeat it year after year. Every chapter is part of a weekly reading, you see, so you'd study it. My father would check up on me on Friday night. What did you learn last week, you see? So you learned the first five books, the Pentateuch, I knew forwards and backwards, and then the rest of the, you know, the prophets and so on. Now, what you studied in the Hebrew school, as you progressed, to be first the Bible, and various emendations and commentaries were studied, and you were called on to recite. And then later, studied the Talmud. And
did you study Hebrew itself?
No, you see, there's a big split on the question of Hebrew. Hebrew is referred to by my father, it's called Lashon HaKodesh, the holy language, the sacred language. And I used to embarrass my father a great deal. I said, supposing you're living at that time in Palestine, and you're in the toilet, and suddenly you don't have toilet paper. What do you say? Hey, get me some toilet paper. In what language would you speak? If you use Hebrew, that's you're profaning the holy language by being in the toilet without having been, so you're unclean. My father was absolutely annoyed at the question, because well, you have to speak, I suppose you don't know any Yiddish. Well, you say it in Arabic. But see, so that we didn't, with Lashon HaKodesh, you have to wear your hat. You must not be uncovered when you speak Hebrew. Well, of course, you see them all the time in Israel now, secular types speaking Hebrew. My father would have been horrified to see people speaking Hebrew without a head covering. The idea was that you recited the Hebrew part but translated it into Yiddish. The discussion between the rabbi was in Yiddish.
Oh, I see. So you learned Yiddish, did you?
Oh, yeah. Yiddish was known as the Mama Lashon, la langue maternelle, the mother language, my mother tongue.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to this guy yesterday, the Russian, Krishkov, to his mother. He talked Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
As an international, lingua franca, or lingua Yiddisha.
Tell me a little bit of what you're about. We're talking about New York in the 1920s now, mm-hmm. really. I mean, that seems to me to be must have been a pretty good time in New York, really. What's your recollection of it?
I don't have a bad recollection at all. What I do have a recollection of is the fighting that went on between Jews and Italians, boys, gang fights. And that was a bit of a problem. See, my friend Joe Ganji was concerned that I'd be beaten up by Italians, so he taught me passwords. Now, when I was a kid, I'd have to deliver packages of goods. Italian women come from the Italian neighborhoods to buy from my father, and then it would have to be delivered. Well, when he was a small peddler, you know, he would deliver it. But when he got a store, he couldn't leave the store to deliver it. So I would be the one sent. The dividing line between the Jewish part of the East Side and the Italian side was the Bowery. Elizabeth Street, Mott Street, those are the places that were Italian. So the moment you crossed the Bowery, you were in enemy territory. Now I'd be carrying a package, and the kids would come up to you and say, a little gang would come up and say, Jew or Italian? You said Jew, bang, bang, your goods would disappear, you'd be beaten up. And then go cowering on stuff. So this happened a couple of times, and my father knew that was true. I'd come back, with a swollen nose or something. And, the cops they didn't bother with things like this. Just being a bunch of kids fighting, that's great. And so Joe Ganji taught me, when they ask you Jew or Italian, tell them you're Italian. And they'll ask you, how do you say bread in Italian? And we practiced how to say it, pane. Pane, okay, go ahead. They didn't ask any other words. That'd have been a disaster if they had.
Did your father's business prosper? I mean, how did he?
I think so, but he was very, very cautious. He never told us anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I managed to get the tuition out of him. That's all I could get, and plus he gave me an allowance. At that time it wasn't too bad, 25 cents a day,
mm-hmm.
which meant at that time the subway fare was a nickel.
Mm-hmm.
So
tuition for what, by the way?
To Columbia College.
Oh, I see.
It was about, those, I forget, $3 a point or something. It was very, you know, compared to today, of course, just phenomenally cheap. But even though $300 was much, I think it was $320 was the tuition. And then I got a job as a waiter.
But wait a minute, are we leaving, aren't we jumping ahead a bit here?
All right.
Isn't there anything in between? You're going to, you're still, we're still in the high school.
Yeah, and I'm out of high school, and I get out in February with,
of
29, 30. I was just barely 17.
The Depression. Do you remember the? Do you remember the October of 29? That's when the stock market.
Oh,
crashed.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Not significant. Not at that time. It was just a lot of noise, you know.
It wasn't something that's particularly affected your father?
Not at all. He never got into stocks or anything. Mm-hmm. You know, he just had a little business, which was enough to feed me and my two sisters, and to have chicken on Friday night. And anyway, I what was your
when you got out of school? What the date was?
Oh, it was February 1930. See, those days you didn't have a June. It could be January. It could be June. So I came out. So I had about 6 months before I could find out if I was going to Columbia or not. Meantime, I had applied. So I got a job as a messenger. And here ensued a very sad thing. The Sabbath. I was going to violate the Sabbath. See, I was a high school graduate, so. And we needed the money. And I was going to get $12 a week as an errand boy at some stationer's house. Stationery and architect supply house on 42nd Street and 3rd Avenue. It was the first real job I'd had, which meant that I could eat at the automat for 10 cents. So, but I had to work on the Sabbath, Saturday, because in those days it was a 6-day week for everybody. And the question was what to do. My father told me he wished I would not work on the Sabbath. I said, that's the only job I have. And I want to, what'll I do about money? And he turned away. And my mother, I remember vividly. And I remember the Sabbath. Normally on the Sabbath morning, I'd go to synagogue with my father. This was the first Sabbath I didn't go. I went to work. And I rode on a car. See, riding on vehicles, public vehicles, is forbidden on the Sabbath. So I did everything. By that time, I was a pretty lost cause.
So you just, how did your father react to that?
Unhappy, but, you know, what could he do?
He wasn't too, he was...
He wasn't commanding me, you know, mm-hmm. I'd leave the house or else. You know, he had adjusted to the fact that he was living in another world. As far as he was concerned, it was the same world he'd left behind. He only spoke Yiddish. Neither of my parents really ever learned to speak English. They managed barely. My father learned to write some in English. Of course, he had to write bills. So he learned that. But he knew Polish, Russian, and Ukrainian. He could speak those languages. I know that because people would come in and he'd speak to them in either of the languages involved. And they used those languages as secret languages to keep us, the children, knowing what they were saying, which is why I don't know any Russian. The only Russian that I really learned from them was when action followed something they said, like when I'd want to stay up late and I started nodding, my mother would say, Malye khochi spat, which is Ukrainian, the little one wants to sleep. That's what I know, because that would be followed immediately by being lifted up and put into bed, you see. Malye khochi spat. So that's the Russian I know. But English to them, I mean, they were living just as they'd lived in the way back in the little village of Kolk.
Of what?
Kolk, K-O-L-K, mm-hmm. In the province of Volyn was the province. And, you know, and why should it be different? My father's, the house was here, a block away was the store, a block away was the synagogue, over here a block away was the kosher butcher. So, I mean, what was the problem? Why do you have to learn all these silly languages like English? The custom is either spoke Italian. My father picked up Italian. He'd go out when he was a peddler, and, Roba buona, boss. cheap dresses, cheap cloth. He could converse in Italian with Italian customers. Mm-hmm. But English, he didn't need English. What was there to talk English about?
How do you feel yourself about the fact that you violated the Sabbath and all of that?
I had no feeling whatsoever.
You had
by
no
that time, that I was a goner. I observed, you know, the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur fasting, but I didn't care very much. I mean, this was nothing. For various reasons, I lost my interest. Lost my interest in being an observing Jew. I just didn't feel it was very important.
Mm-hmm.
And no
great guilt feelings or anything?
None. To this day.
I see.
But I'm very grateful that I got a very good education in the Bible. A very good education. But you see, they had a lot of questions which could not be answered, and that sort of, you know, turned me off. There were some very important ethical questions that are raised. I got very furious. For example, it says in Genesis, when Rebekah is bearing Esau and Jacob, and it says that the children churned within her. And the commentary explains this, that when Rebekah passed a temple of the infidel, Esau wanted to get out. And when she passed a synagogue, Jacob wanted to get out. Now, this is all nonsense, but that was the commentary. So I said, why? That's not fair, because even before they were born, they're already doomed. One is going to be, you know, full of, you know, guilt, the goy, and the other ones, I mean, where was the... Well, you know, the rabbi would get furious because I wouldn't take his answer. And then I got kicked out of my Hebrew school twice. My father pleaded with me, must you ask all these questions? So I'd ask him questions. I was like, can God commit suicide? Mm-hmm. I said, what kind of a question is that? Well, if God is immortal, then he can't commit suicide, which means he's not all-powerful. If he's all-powerful, then he could commit suicide, then he wouldn't be immortal. You know, little games like that I used to play. And it was obvious I was not going to be a rabbi.
Sidney Hook described to me having similar sort of arguments with his father, really.
Oh, yes.
And now there are a lot of people like Sidney, or people younger, who now are fairly well known in public life and so on. And do any of these people, names that you know, did people that you knew from way back then in New York?
No, because you see, the East Side, nobody came out of the East Side. That is, the people I played with and hung around with through high school, they just disappeared out of my life because they didn't go to Columbia. You have no idea what a revolutionary change it is to have gone to Columbia rather than City College at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Because Columbia had a different world.
Yes.
I mean, I met people from Arkansas. I never heard of Arkansas, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
It was an entirely different world. And it was a world I liked, and I immediately went out for the college paper.
Now, tell me again why you were so eager to go to Columbia.
I wanted to break out of the East Side mm-hmm. mold. And there are ways people could do it. You could do it politics. You could become a doctor. I don't know. I didn't want to be a doctor. I wanted to be a newspaper man. I wanted very much to be a reporter. And I got into a long correspondence with H.L. Mencken, whose letters I have somewhere.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'd write him for advice. I found it a lot of fun. I wrote to Haywood Bruin, a name, I don't know if you know it.
Yes.
He was a columnist
right.
on The World. I wrote him. And I think it's astounding. I never expected I'd get into Columbia, because Columbia had a numerous classes. And
had what?
A numerous classes, a quota.
Mm-hmm.
Numerous classes. It's a phrase used in medieval times to refer to certain quotas. So many Jews could live here, or so many Jews go to a medical school. And the numerous classes was well known. It was described in a book by Haywood Bruin and a guy named George Britt called Christians Only. It's one of the early books about anti-Semitism in the United States. And he described the numerous classes at Columbia and many other Ivy League schools. So I didn't know what I was...
This was limiting the number of Jews?
Yeah, to a percentage, 10%.
I see.
In the case of Columbia. So I remember writing a letter to Heywood Broun saying, I've read your book, Christians Only, and Heywood Broun was teaching at Columbia School of Journalism. I said, since you're at Columbia, the professor of the School of Journalism, and you've written this book saying numerous classes at Columbia, will you help me get in to Columbia? And I've been editor of the paper, and so whether he did anything or not, I just don't know. But I got in, and I remember having a personal interview, and the interviewer was a very nice man.
This was up at Columbia.
At Columbia. Yeah. You had to come up for a personal interview. Mm-hmm. And he asked me questions like, who is chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee? And I said, William E. Borah. Oh. And then he asked me questions about, I would see at that point, I was reading newspapers